Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. First edition news with Willem van Dender, and shortly in our former ITN journo turned pundit, Derek Bison, still in transit from the States. He'll be back with us again next week. But first up, it's back to the future for the Socceroos as their World Cup assignment for the third round of qualifying has been announced. The group of death yet again with Japan and Saudi Arabia for the third time in a row, and only the top two teams guaranteed automatic qualification. Graham Arnold's men will open their campaign at home on September 5 against Bahrain, then travel to Indonesia, Japan away, and the Saudis at home. Willem will have it all for us as they look to confirm their spot in the 2026 tournament. The good news is that there are plenty of at least two other opportunities after that should they not get through. We'll talk to it all with ESPN Asia and the Asian Games' Scott McIntyre. Then, as the BBC's Phil McNulty wrote, Jude Bellingham produced a moment of genius to keep England in Euro 2024 as they survived another desperate display and a huge scare to beat Slovakia in dramatic fashion to reach the last eight. England was seconds away from an embarrassing exit in Gelsenkirchen as Slovakia defended a lead they'd held since the 25th minute, only to have their hearts ripped out. Before the game, our always reliable correspondent Rob Tanner wrote in The Athletic that Gareth Southgate needed to make wholesale changes to his lineup and tactics. He didn't, and they got through by the skin of their teeth with the imperious Swiss up next, fresh from knocking out the Azzurri. The Three Lions will need something more than a miracle goal to get through that. We'll talk to Rob about it all. Edge, really loving this time of year. It's obviously a different experience the way that we get to watch football. You've got to sort of balance things out when you watch some games live and some on delay. Then during the day, you've got to try and have a few blackouts, media blackouts to watch the copper results. But it's just a feast, isn't it?
It is a feast. And I watched two games live over the weekend in good time zones. One was Italy's shock exit and the other one was England's shock win. So it was pretty exciting. And back home here in Australia, Rob, the A-League coaching merry-go-round, all the puzzle was starting to fall into place, and Willem's got an update on that shortly too. So lots to talk about on this show, and football never stops, Willem, does it?
No, it doesn't, Michael. Hello to you as well, Rob. Good to be back for another week. Bit of a civil war brewing at home, though, in Australia around the Matildas, and this is an unpleasant one. Matildas legend, of course, Julie Dolan, has rejected Football Australia's move to commemorate the members of the 1975 St. George Budapest side that competed at the first Women's Asian Cup as the first Matildas. A working group has recommended all 16 members of the squad be recognised as A internationals and should share the cap number zero, or digit zero. Although the side did compete under the national coat of arms and colours, in the absence of a formal national women's outfit, Dolan has slammed the move as farcical. And Ed, you're going to run through Julie's response. She stressed that a lack of trials and interstate players meant that this makes a mockery of the national selection processes, and that she was only 14 at the time, and she used an example of an older player who would have been a far more deserving national representative at the time, who wasn't there as proper process hadn't played out, and is therefore not a Matilda as a result.
Yeah, this is not a new issue. This has been bubbling away for many years, and the Chris Nicoll-led administration had dealt with this issue twice and decided, after consulting all the people involved, that it wasn't actually a national team. It was just a club team in a international sort of club-friendly tournament. So that was sort of dead and buried, but it looks like the new Anta Isaac-led administration has resurfaced this issue. They went to great lengths, Football Australia, to say that they'd consulted all sorts of luminaries around the world about, what clarifies as a international and all that sort of stuff. But the two people they didn't consult was one, Julie Dolan, who was involved in everything around that time. And she's also the, Matilda cap number one. The Julie Dolan medal is named after for the best player in the A-League women's competition. She's a fairly significant figure in the sport. They didn't even talk to her. And secondly, one of the eminent historians of women's football in Australia also wasn't consulted. And they have been quoted extensively in the media in the last sort of 10 or 12 hours, sort of using the words like farcical, So it's a really interesting one. And the Matildas Alumni Network, which I know a few, they're all a bit perplexed by this announcement, a bit confused by it. They thought this year was dead and buried. And don't forget this 1975 team, or the team they're calling the 1975s, was that one, Rob, who did the ambush marketing deal with Puma around the World Cup, which left a bitter taste in many people's mouths. So, interesting one. I must admit, it's left people perplexed in the women's game, put it that way.
Edge, when you dropped the story onto our WhatsApp chat, I was gobsmacked. The fact that we're celebrating the Matildas as the most loved team in Australian sport right now, we're all trying to get behind them ahead of the Olympics. It's just dropped at exactly the wrong time. Now, I'm not suggesting that the players in France, they're in Spain in, you know, high performance training right now, fine tuning, but no one needs any of this at the best of times, let alone when you've got the actual team itself going into a tournament. We need solidarity amongst this group. And, you know, it's, look, I don't know what the answer to this is. There's too much grey for me in all of the conversation to think that there's a perfect answer. The fact, as you say, that Julie Dolan wasn't consulted, and she's made it very clear that she wasn't consulted, is probably the biggest fly in the ointment of the whole lot. Did they just not consult her because they knew what the answer was going to be, so they just locked her out altogether and made the decision unilaterally without including her, and then hoped that she wouldn't say anything? Well, she's certainly thrown the grenade in the middle of all that now.
Well, she said, what does it say to all those people who have gone through due process to be selected for their country? It really devalues that in my estimation. I mean, what is the purpose of this? This is our governing body. How are we supposed to, as national team players, have any faith in the governing body that made this decision? I know there's a lot of people within that organisation, Football Australia, that battled so hard to not have this happen. It's very hard when you sit outside those organisations to know just whose agenda is on the table. And she said that she's going to reject the FA's offer to a new cap for all of those 16 people who will be numbered zero. She said she's not going to accept that cap as a way of protest. I mean, it's an ugly spat and something that was just not needed. It was a resolved issue. It's a strange one.
There was a resolved issue for the people it was resolved for, but clearly not the 1975 side. They weren't ever happy with the way that it was resolved. So I'm not, again, saying it, anything's right or wrong, but a decision had been made. They weren't happy with it. They kept fighting it, and now they've got someone on the board with the current chairman who agrees with them, and he's flipped everything on its head.
Yeah, Greg Werner, who's a soccer historian and co-author of the Encyclopedia of Matildas, said the decision had opened up a Pandora's box because two of the 16 players had not even made it onto the park in 1975, but were now considered A internationals. As such, Werner said others who've sat on the bench for Matildas but never earned an official cap could now have legitimate cases to prosecute their case with Football Australia. He said it's puzzling to say the least. Mm. This was rejected last year. We've had a change of FA chair. Chris Nicu left, and it's back on the agenda. And obviously the numbers are there for it to be driven through. I haven't seen any evidence that would make me change my mind. Had there been evidence given to me, maybe it would have, but I haven't seen anything yet. So he's calling it as a political decision. Interesting.
Yep. Let's leave it at that. Yep, that's what he said. But if you're listening and you want to read any more of it, Vince Rigari has written a great article in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age that outlines it all. And embedded in that article is another article which goes back to the ambush marketing campaign that took place. So if you want to get up to speed, jump on the Nine publications and have a read.
We'll be back to the Euros with Rob Tanner later on in the program. So we'll rattle on to the Copa America. Argentina and Venezuela have taken maximum points from the group stage in the US to move to the quarterfinals, although Mexico will not be joining them after a nil-all draw with Ecuador. That result means that it's the third time in their past four Copa appearances that Mexico have failed to progress. As we record those quarterfinals, read Argentina against Ecuador and Venezuela against Canada, who have progressed on their tournament day at Blue. But Edge, just quickly, we spoke about Mexico last week. It's gone from bad to much worse in that intervening period. And they've got some real work to do ahead of what is, of course, a home World Cup for them coming up.
Yeah, we've talked about it, didn't we, last edition of the program. I was in Mexico, and yeah, there's a feeling of disquiet in the football community in Mexico that they are a regional power that is not delivering on expectations. It's such a huge and historic football nation. I mean, the Azteca Stadium will be the first stadium in the world to host three World Cup matches in three World Cups, you know. So that's the significance of Mexico to the international football community. And yeah, the Mexican fans, they deserve better. Yeah, it's a bit of a shock that the team is in decline.
Yeah, I've got them in my stoppage time summary with a little bit more detail on all of that. And I can ask a couple of questions to get into the nitty gritty of your experiences down there, Reg. So if you're listening now and you want a little bit more on that, tune in later in the week.
Socceroos have drawn Japan and Saudi Arabia for the third straight World Cup qualification cycle. The expanded tournament means two direct spots are on offer from a group that also features Bahrain, Indonesia and China. As you outlined, Rob, a third place finish would afford a chance at another two direct spots later down the track. Australia failed to beat either Japan or Saudi Arabia through four attempts during Qatar 2022 qualifying. They're going to kick off the September window with lighter assignments against Bahrain and Indonesia. So Edge, five consecutive cycles against Japan, and I'll come to you on this as well, Rob. Still no meeting with Iran. For some people, that's a good thing. They never want to see him again still. And for others, they want a taste of it and another go at him. Not that it would mean the same thing, but you take my point.
I do. And I mean, all of us that have got a vested interest in the Socceroos qualifying for the World Cup, we've looked down at those games. And obviously, the home matches against Saudi and Japan for the Socceroos are absolutely critical, as are the away games. But the last match of the whole qualifying phase, Australia has to go to Saudi Arabia in June, where it'll be 50 degrees. Yeah, interesting that that's the case. And I've got a feeling it's going to come down to that, Willem.
Do you want to see Iran one day, Rob, or still happy never to have to look at them again?
Oh, mate, I love the theatre of sport regardless. Sometimes I find myself barracking for other nations in sport just to see competition. So I'd love to see that happen again, some kind of all-on-the-line match to like Uruguay. I must never forget that. Not one of the greatest moments in Australian sporting history, and certainly one of the best moments that I've ever experienced in a sporting environment at Homebush when we finally broke the drought, the atmosphere in that stadium. So MCG, you know, 40-odd years on, Australia play Iran, it's all on the line to qualify. Yeah, no, we get revenge.
Come on, can we do that?
Here it is.
As long as I don't know whether Peter Hall is still alive, mate, but as long as he's locked up somewhere safe and secure.
No, we don't want to go through that again.
Yeah, well, I don't want to go through the wrong result again, but I'd like to sort of rip the scab off that wound. So yeah,
but it is the toughest group. I think even Japan, it'd be interesting. We talked to Scott McIntyre tonight, so it'll be interesting to see what the reaction has been in Japan to securing Australia and Saudi Arabia. It's definitely the toughest of the three groups and the most competitive. And Indonesia, who had a great Asian Cup. I mean, we've got some. Yeah. Banana skins in there, Willem.
We do, but sorry, I'm not Willem, but you know, look at last time. We got through by the skin of our teeth and then got through to the second round. And you know, with some sliding doors moments that have slid the other way, we might have knocked the ultimate winner out of the tournament. So, you know, we don't get through Japan and Saudi top the group. There's two other opportunities.
Obviously, there's two other opportunities. We've got that round-robin tournament in what they call Phase 4. You would expect us to get through that probably.
And then there's the intercontinental playoff still.
Yeah.
So nine spots all told for the AFC, nine spots. So I think
we've got to be in one of those. But, yeah, it's going to be a fascinating World Cup qualification campaign, isn't it, Willem?
And if you want to get to the big show at the end of it all, head to ggatravel.com.au for that Men's World Cup in the USA, Canada and Mexico. Socceroos and Matilda Central for the Green and Gold Army this week in memory of Socceroo number 188, Alan Westwater, who has passed aged 78. He had a long association with football in both New South Wales and in Scotland and played three seasons with Stirling Albion over there before eventually coming home. He was part of the Socceroos side that played the Friendly Nations Cup in Vietnam in 1968. Or 67, that should read. All up, he scored twice in 14 appearances for the national team, Rob.
And very briefly, Willem, I had a recent experience at Brighton Golf Club. I know I mentioned it a little while ago. I bumped into a Socceroo down there, but another Scottish form-born player who played for the Socceroos, George Keith, of that era, is a guy I wanted to give a shout-out to, a member of the Football Federation of Australia, or the Football Australia Hall of Fame these days. So, yeah, the Scottish in that sort of burgeoning period, we look at the more recent Scottish influence on Australian football, but it's been around for a long, long time.
£10 great people from Great Britain. £10. Imagine paying £10 to get on the boat to Australia with them.
Yeah, I'll do that back home and save some coin at the minute.
Yeah,
another week, another win. Yeah, I've got that on my sleeve. Another week, another win for Kevin Muscat at Shanghai Port. 3-1 over Zhejiang, despite a red card for his side. They are top by 2 points through 17 games, despite having won pretty much all of them. There is another side right on the hammer, so they're being made to earn it. Staying in Asia, Edge, in South Korea, these blokes we don't speak about enough, but there's Aussie defenders that plug away every week. Harrison Delbridge, Aaron Culver and Lockie Jackson, all regulars in the top flight. And also back in the country is Connor Chapman, who's made his debut this week for K2 side Gimpo Citizen. Those boys have been whiling away over there for that long.
They have, and a great place to live, Korea, and the football over there is really high profile, and we know the quality of it because the Korean teams do exceptionally well in the Asian Champions League, don't they, in their head-to-head stuff with the Japanese in particular.
Remiss me not to mention that last week, Winona Heatley, who would be feeling a little bit blue having been left out of the Olympic squad, did skipper FC Nordsjælland to the Danish Cup title. A 2-1 win over Brøndby in the final, and to wear the armband and lift the trophy is significant. So well done to her. And that also means the double for the club, having also won the Kvindaliga league title. And to close, before we get Scotty McIntyre on, a big goal from Mitch Duke in the J-League title fight against Gamba Osaka. We'll flesh that out a little bit more with him later on, Rob.
Excellent. All right, mate. Well done. Lots to talk over and a few things, I think, within that bulletin that that we're going to flesh out over coming weeks. But up next, our good mate, he's up in Tokyo, Scott McIntyre. He he's always available to talk to us about the Asian game from a Japanese point of view, but obviously with his Aussie heritage. What do the Japanese think of this group? Are they sick and tired of seeing us again? They seem to get the better of us more often than not. Famously not in 2006. Maybe they want their revenge still for that in a World Cup setting. We'll talk to Scott next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
It is what it is, said Graham Arnold as the Socceroos were drawn against Japan for the sixth consecutive World Cup qualification cycle last week as part of Group B, or Group C rather, that also includes Saudi Arabia, China, Indonesia and Bahrain. It's an outcome so familiar that there may have been a few rolled eyes, but nevertheless, it means we are once again in need of keeping those eyes on the Samurai Blue. So there is none better to go to when that is the case than Scott McIntyre of the Asian Game. Scott, welcome back, mate.
Hello, guys. Great to be back.
Australian fans, I think we're probably craving a degree of variety here, considering Saudi Arabia has also landed in the group with us, Oz, and Japan for the third consecutive cycle. So what has the reaction been like over on your side of the world?
Yeah, I think like you said, obviously the first thing is it's a very hard group. I mean, I think when you saw the pots and the way that they were divided, the expectation was whoever were going to get Saudi Arabia from pot three was probably going to be the toughest group. So that was the one that you would have liked to have avoided, obviously, for all those nations, the same for Japan and the same for Australia. So it's a very tough group. But yeah, like you said, the third straight time that it's Australia, Saudi and Japan. Obviously, last time Saudi topped that group and Japan finished second, Australia to go through the playoff. We know what happened there. But yeah, just aside from that, you know, for fans that are traveling or for people that are covering the game, it would have been nice just to have something different. I would have loved to see North Korea drawn with Japan again, just to see if they were going to boycott for the second time. This is still a crazy story, right? North Korea in the second round boycotted a game.
They made it through,
and they copped a 3-0 defeat. Whereas they could have copped more, and I mean, it didn't come down to any end, but it could have come down to goal difference. So they've set an outrageous standard for teams just boycotting the toughest match in the group. Maybe.
Well, they play their home games in this phase of qualification in North Korea, do you think?
Well, that's what I'm not sure, because they played the last two in Laos. So they managed to swing it unbelievably. So they had the two matches back-to-back to to finish the group. So they didn't need to travel. Teams that need to travel in and out. Yeah, that's a crazy story. Indonesia's a great one as well, I think, for Australia.
It is. This is, it's going to be a fantastic fixture, that one.
Yeah, this is something that I've been hammering on for ages, you know, because I don't know how many fans know, but we're actually part of the ASEAN, the Southeast Asian region. But for me, really disappointingly, we don't participate at any level in any of those competitions. The one massive one, which is coming up again at the end of this year, it's been called various things down the year, the Tiger Cup, the Suzuki Cup is now called the Mitsubishi Electric Cup, and I think it may have even changed again. But the Southeast Asian tournament, which I've been to, I think the last four.
It's a great tournament. It's a ripper.
It's just unbelievable. And why we're not in that is such a shame. But we're going to play Indonesia. Unfortunately, I believe we're not playing them at the Gelora Bung Karno, the 100,000-seater in Jakarta, because I believe the Pope is in town. In that particular match day. So it's been moved to another venue in a different city, which is a shame. But yeah, I think, you know, those kind of ties between Australia and Indonesia and Southeast Asia, the more that they grow, I think the better that will be. So yeah, I'm really happy. What's happening in Indonesian football is a fascinating story as well, because they're kind of tapping, or not tapping in, they're fully diving into the diaspora. So I think in the last couple of games, almost 75% of the starting 11 were of Dutch origin. And so they've gone on a crazy wild naturalization process, which is probably the last time they can do it, because if you look at the colonial history of Indonesia, you're kind of talking grandparents rather than parents. So they've gone, okay, we're going to put all our chips in. Of course, Indonesia was Asia's first ever World Cup representative. But what they're doing now is that they're getting like top quality players who are playing in the Eredivisie, who've played at big clubs in big leagues. And I think they're going to be we can talk closer to that game, but I think they're going to be a real threat actually to upset this group, because it's basically a Dutch B team at the moment that they're turning out. And yeah, anyone who writes them off, obviously Japan and Saudi are the headlines, but yeah, I think Indonesia are going to be really, really tough as well.
Didn't you see the Dutch A team the other day, Scott? They're not going that well themselves. Our friendly foes, the Samurai Blue, just three competitive matches since the Asian Cup, since that cancellation, of course, still under the management of your good friend Moriyasu. How do we find him?
Yeah, well, I'm not a massive fan of Moriyasu, obviously. I mean, the players, it's always been the thing, you know, the players are good. Good players that are doing good things at big clubs in big leagues. So yeah, they're obviously, you know, they're going to be a massive threat. I don't think they're unbeatable. Absolutely not. You know, a lot of attention here is focused obviously Japan and going to the Olympics in the men's and the women's. So I think for now that's the kind of main focus. But once that's done, yeah, the attention will turn to those qualifiers. And it's not just that match, you know, because the Saudi games will be big. Like I said, the Indonesian games will be big. As well. So the group's tricky, but obviously with the expansion to 48 teams, you know, even if you don't finish in the top two here, you only need to finish third and fourth and you get through to the next phase. And then there's another shot even after that as well, if you get the half slot to the Intercontinental Playoff Tournament as well. So you've got to really kind of muck it up not to get to the World Cup. Obviously, it would be great to have it, all sealed and delivered before then. But, you know, even if you don't finish in the top two here, you've got another shot. Yeah, I think it would be great, you know, to even see, you know, Indonesia maybe grab one of those spots as well to go through. And let's see what happens. I mean, it's a tough group. You look at some of the other groups, Korea's group with the five West Asian nations, but that probably a little bit easier. So it's going to be tough. But yeah, the format of it means that you've got a good shot to get there.
What do you make of the format? You say you need a good shot to get there, and of course with 48 there's going to be a big degree of that jeopardy just ruined. And international teams, I mean, you think of Australia, Japan, we only play so many competitive fixtures there. They're very important, A, because you've got to qualify, but they also really do sharpen the knife. But as we sit here looking at the structure, is there jeopardy, or has that maybe only come through, have they maybe been saved here by the improvement in an Indonesia or nations in and around that it is going to be competitive? I don't know how I've sort of packaged that question to you.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, it's good. It's good to play these matches, obviously, to have competitive games. Like I said, you obviously you want to get to the World Cup, right? So you want to get one of these two automatic spots and go through. But if you don't, you really got to properly like screw it up to not get through at this point. So you would think all the big guns get through. And then the question is, it opens up the door for other nations, you know, maybe in Iraq to return to the World Cup, Uzbekistan and so on. So there's a lot of great stories, I think, that can come from the region. But if you're a Socceroos fan, you've got to be very, very confident that, you know, even if things don't go the way you'd like them to go in this third round, you've got another two rounds and the playoff after that potentially to get through as well. So, yeah, you know, yeah, I don't know. I personally like the expanded World Cup. I think it's a good thing. I think it's inclusive. And, yeah, but it makes qualification maybe a little bit easier than it would have otherwise been.
Yeah, I think the big thing about the 48 teams is it's electrifying the level of football that never thought that they would get an opportunity to qualify for a World Cup. So Indonesia is a good example. I mean, just, you know, Willem, Scott and I live in the region, so where I live in Thailand, I've been observing major changes at the Thai FA as very important people in Thailand, in the government and the royal family, have lent on people to roll over and leaves, you know, Madam Wu, who's gone to the top of the pile as the new president of the Thai FA, is a very serious person, and it's all about resetting to try and get them into World Cup qualification in the next cycle. So, and that's because there's bigger opportunities and there's more opportunities, and I think that's fantastic. And I mean, the gap has been, I don't know what Scott thinks, but I do think the teams like Indonesia, for example, are starting to bridge the gap a little bit. Their performances at the Asian Cup are an example of that.
Yeah, I'm a little bit disappointed personally what happened in Thailand because, I've known Mano Polking, the former coach, and I think he was, shuffled aside maybe a little bit unfairly. That's maybe a story for a different time. But yeah, it definitely opens the door for other nations. But I think the ones that are really doing well, like we touched on in Indonesia and also Iraq, who are tapping in massively to the diaspora as well. So those teams that have a diaspora of quality to tap into in Iraq, do so many, you know, so many kids that grew up playing in Sweden, for example, that have come through. Guys like Zinedine Iqbal, who grew up in England, came through the Manchester United Academy and was really highly regarded at that club. I've spoken with quite a few of these kind of emerging Iraqi talents, and I think they're a real massive chance to get back to the World Cup for the second time in their history and probably do well when they get there as well. So yeah, Iraq, Indonesia, calling in players from abroad, which you can do under the regulations and the guidance. It's obviously worked for Australia in the past as well. So, them and then maybe someone like Uzbekistan who qualified for the Olympics, who I think will do very, very well in the Olympics, who put a lot of money into developing their younger teams. They're one of these countries that slotted an Olympic age team into the national the top division in Uzbekistan. It did quite well. I think they finished sixth and seventh in the first couple of seasons in the domestic league as well. So I think they're a team to watch out for the Olympics, and there's some players that are playing really well in big European clubs as well. So yeah, the Uzbeks are another one to watch, and this is what we want in our region: more competitive games, more competitive countries, more eyeballs on players going to bigger leagues and developing. And I think it helps strengthen Asia, which, yeah, hopefully Australia can get into the Southeast Asian thing and do the same in Southeast Asia, and we can see the whole confederation grow and develop.
Let's change gears and talk J-League for a moment, get your comments on how the Australian interests are doing there. I think the first one speaks for itself. Harry Kuehl at Yokohama, they've slid down the table massively. They've lost three of their last five. They're in 12th position on the table. I mean, how's he going?
Oh, I think the club's struggling, yeah. It was a bit of an unusual situation because they came in, you know, with the calendar flip for the Champions League. So they had the end part where obviously they got right the way through to the final. So that was a priority, you know, pretty much when he came in to get through and get to the final. So they had a few league games postponed, which they had to catch up, which means there's been a crush of fixtures in the last 2 months or so. And yeah, obviously did very, very well final of the ACL, but domestically it's not been good at all. And they got booed off. They lost to a promoted club, Inverti, at the weekend, and the players and the fans got booed off. But you saw Kuehl go over to the fans, and most people will just bow and apologise, but he kind of had a little bit of a chip back at them, kind of shaking his head and saying this is not the done thing, which it probably is the done thing in Japan. It's not the done thing, his reaction. So yeah, from what I'm hearing, there's certainly growing pressure on his position. There's a break in the league coming up at the end of this month. So I wouldn't be surprised if they've got a makeup game this week, and then I think two more games before that break. So yeah, if they struggled in these next three games, I wouldn't be surprised if a move was made.
But one of the great news stories is Mitchell Duke and his team, top of the table. They've a promoted team. They're taking all before them. They are 5 points clear on top of the table, and he scored over the weekend. Machida, tell us about how Mitch is going.
Yeah, well, personally for Mitch, it hasn't been a great season. This game on the weekend was his first league start. He's been injured in and out a little bit. I know he came back early from the national camp, didn't he, in the last game as well?
He did. He's
featured a little bit in the cup, but not so much in the league. This is a fascinating story, actually, this Machida one. We could go for a long time on this story. So not only are they a promoted team, they're in J1 it's the first time in their history. And yeah, halfway through the league, they're topping the league, and they're doing it playing not good football, to be honest. I mean, un-Japanese football. They're like they're a throwback team. You know, it's a 4-4-2. They kind of got a guy that makes long throw-ins. They tend to go very direct. They've got a couple of big guys up front. They work very, very hard off the ball. But the most fascinating element of it all is that the guy that got them promoted last year was in his first season as a professional coach. I mean, he spent 25 years coaching at high school football in Japan, very successfully, mind you, the kind of the powerhouse club in the north of Japan, a team called Aomori Yamada, which have developed a lot of national team plays and so on. But yeah, 25 years as a high school coach, then you go your very first year. I think he had to catch up his badges and everything as well. He got them promoted in the first year, and now he's got them sitting top of the table. The J-League has a history for this. Twice in the past, promoted teams have gone on to win the league, but never a team in their first year in the league. So it's a fascinating story. I wonder if Mitch might move on loan, maybe, or not in this window. The window opens shortly. But yeah, he spoke after the match that he was happy. You know, he had to wait patiently for his chance. And yeah, you can't do more than scoring a goal. And yeah, the club, the whole thing around it, the coaching situation, the fact that a debut club is top of the league halfway through the season, is a fascinating story.
What's their fan base like?
Are not very good. So they're technically part of the Tokyo region, but they're kind of much closer to Yokohama than central Tokyo. So, and the stadium's a little bit ugly. It's one of these prefectural stadiums, a little bit hard to get to access-wise. We're probably one of the worst in the country to get to. I don't know, they average maybe 10,000 or so. So they're a kind of club hidden away in the backdoor corridor of Tokyo, not in the sexy and flashy part of town. But yeah, the whole story is just fascinating.
Well, one club that is in the sexy and flashy part of town, FC Tokyo, a massive club. Peter Klimovsky, tell us about them. They're eighth on the table.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that make it hard. I think a bit hard for Pete at the moment. There's a lot of older players on big contracts that are a little bit hard to move. So he's had his hands tied a little bit in terms of the transfer market. But yeah, the football is definitely there, and I think they're really building towards something special. I don't think that will be this year, but I wouldn't be surprised next year when you can get a lot of those contracts off the books and bring in players that maybe fits his brand of football a little bit better. He's also used a predominantly Japanese 11 for most of the season, which is a little bit unusual. But yeah, they're playing good football, and you can see that the structure is there, and the way that he wants them to play is there. And they're playing very aggressive football, the same kind of thing. You know, obviously what we see with Ange, you know, this kind of football. Pete was with Ange for whatever it was, 10 years or so. It's football from this school. It's building and it's growing. I don't think it'll come this year, but I think next year that they could be a real force.
Scott, we'll let you go. Comprehensive as always. We'll keep your predictions around Indonesia in mind as internationally the region continues to grow. And always good to get an update on how our Aussies go in the best league in Asia. So thank you very much as always.
No worries, guys.
Got McIntyre of the Asian game there. On the other side of the break, the two Robs will be back, Tanner and Gilbert, to pick through what we saw from England last night.
Hey, Willem.
Bup. Yes, Rob.
Stock up and save right now at Chemist Warehouse.
Always should if you want to save some cash, Rob. But you also know how good Chemist Warehouse is for you. You'll have plenty of gear in plenty of their gear in your cupboard.
Oh,
and yeah, pinch those pennies while you can.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, we've all got to save these days. I mean, interest rates, they're not coming down. The cost of living is just skyrocketing. And, you know, for every few dollars you can save, it's back in your pocket, not in somebody else's. And if you've got young kids, it gets even more expensive. You know what it's like bringing up young kids. You have to have the medicine cabinet full at just the right time, don't you?
Absolutely, because you never know where they're going to be sick, you know. And, Chemist Warehouse, it's always your best friend in those times when you've got to do the dandy dollar dash to get something that's not in the medicine cabinet.
Exactly. So if you haven't got this and you've got young children, get the Panadol Children's 5 to 12 years, as Willem's chuckling
along. What?
Doesn't know what Ed just talking about.
He doesn't know what the dandy dollar dash is, does he, Rob?
It's young kids, I'm all over it.
Well, back in the day, there used to be a football competition called the VFA in Victoria, and it used to be broadcast on the old Channel O, which was Channel 10. And at halftime, they'd have the Dandy Building Society would put up $500, and it was an all-comers entrance. And they would do this a 400-metre dash at halftime. It was called the Dandy Dollar Dash.
Yeah, and for all of our West Australian, Tasmanian, Queensland, and even me, Western Suburbs of Sydney, boy, I'm just assuming that the Dandy...
There's Adam Hilton behind the glass. Do you know what the Dandy Dollar Dash is?
Adam Hilton is the head of Stratosphere Agency. He's Chemist Warehouse's agency. Our man behind the glass is Adam Maloney.
Adam Maloney, I should say.
let's move along from the Dandy Dollar Dash from the great suburb of Dandenong. As I was saying, the Panadol Children's 5 to 12 years, orange or strawberry, 200 mils, $19.99. You're not going to buy it cheaper anywhere. And the Betadine sore throat gargle, the worst thing in the world during the depths of winter is a sore throat, 120 mils, $10.99. That'll sort that out. Now, while you're at Chemist Warehouse, you can save on vitamins and supplements. I'm always banging on about it. Ostalin, calcium, and vitamin D3 plus magnesium. Now, the calcium, strength for your bones. D3 helps the calcium absorb. Magnesium, great for the joints and the muscles. All in one. 200 tablets, just $30.99. That's 45% off. And Barocca Energy or Immune, 60 tablets, just $19.99 each. Well, and where are they at?
They are at Chemist Warehouse. Ka-ching.
Exactly, where the great savings are every single day.
Box to box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. And as our next guest would be well aware, Rob Tanner from The Athletic. On the opposite side of the world, we watch the Euros in a very different way to what the Europeans watch the Euros. We have games at 2 a.m., at 5 a.m. So at least in the modern era, we've got the luxury of streaming platforms that allow us to watch games with spoiler alerts baked in so that you know that you can watch a game that was played at 2 a.m. and generally not know what the score is. Rob, I was watching that game on delay, England v Slovakia. There were 87 seconds to go, and I could feel the nervous tension in my body as Jude Bellingham saw that ball and wheel around, and the gut-wrenching feeling for the Slovakians. Well, first of all, how were you feeling as you were watching it in real time?
It was just utter relief because it had been such a poor performance up until that moment. They didn't have a shot on target. I mean, obviously it hit the post and went close a few times, but they've just been stumbling through this tournament so far. And to be fair, the sides they've played against haven't been the most ambitious sides as well. So it hasn't made for great watching. It hasn't exactly been end to end. I mean, Slovakia got their goal and just sat in, didn't they? And try to be compact like all the sides in the group stage as well. So it doesn't make for great watching at the moment. And the fact that England are struggling to unlock them, struggling for a bit of inspiration. But then you need your big players to step up in those defining moments. I mean, that was heading towards another Iceland, which ironically was the start of the Southgate era because old Roy had to go after that debacle. And then we've had some really good success up to this point, but and this tournament had been so far has been really lackluster from England. I've started to cover a bit of England for The Athletic and been sent to the press conferences because I literally only live about 20 miles down the road from the St George's Park where they
do a lot of their press stuff. So I've been going to the press conferences, and Gareth Southgate's demeanour in those press conferences has been of a man that looks like, you know, he's had enough. This is a tournament too far. That the pressure's got to him in many ways, and he doesn't want it anymore. And now, if I'm getting that vibe off him, then what's his players getting from him? You know, and I think that we've seen that because it has been a lackluster performance so far from England, and more, not more so than Slovakia. But Jude Bellingham has had an incredible season, not been particularly great in the last few England games, and he steps up with that that fantastic equaliser. And then, sure enough, Harry Kane comes up with what proved to be the winner in the start of extra time. But they really are making really hard work of this so far.
So I guess for a person who observes the English setup in the camp, and, you know, Gareth Southgate, you've known him historically from his days as a player to now the hangdog expression that he seems to be getting around with these days, he clearly doesn't understand that he doesn't have the magic touch. I mean, we watch that pretty much within hours of that game, what a proper, well-coached team can do when a minnow puts one on their chin and they come back marauding the way that Spain did against Georgia and said, oh, you think you're going to take us on? This is how we deal with minnows, and just knock them out for the count. If England, who seem to have the same set of skills within their players, the same depth in this generational side, why is it that Southgate can't put together the pieces of the puzzle to get the players moving like the symphony? It's like he is a maestro without a baton that's working, and the players in the orchestra are just doing whatever they like.
Because he's got the brass section in the wind section, the wind section in the brass section at the moment. It's all muddled thinking at the moment. I mean, he started making his excuses well before the tournament started about the number of players that fatigue, number of players coming back from injury, number of players that are injured. He's got no fit left back. He hasn't got a left-footed player in that back four. Having said that, they've looked pretty solid, although they're going to miss Mark Gay for the next game against Switzerland. I sensed an atmosphere because I was at the Tottenham Hotspur training ground when the squad was announced. And it was leaking throughout the day that the likes of Jack Grealish and James Maddison were being left out of the squad. And they are a couple of players that can bring you an X factor. But, you know, they were undercooked. They hadn't played much. They've had injuries this season, like a lot of the England players have. But he seemed to be making a lot of those excuses that he's having to manage injuries all the time and player conditioning all the time, rather than just, you know. But if you keep delivering that message, psychologically becomes an issue, not physically, psychologically. And if you look at these England performances, and I was at the Iceland game, Finland game at Wembley just before the tournament, the last warm-up game. And it was very similar to what we're seeing now in the tournament. Players showing no ambition on the ball, fear, not playing forwards, trying to play the safe pass all the time, not wanting to take individual responsibility. I've criticise a little bit Jude Bellingham for the previous performances, because, you know, his body language has been poor at times. You know, he's been throwing his arms up the air, exasperated at his teammates for not giving him the ball or giving him in the wrong place, for not pressing. But he stepped up. He did take the responsibility, and that's what top players do. But the rest do seem to be like scared. They're lacking confidence. They're lacking the belief that they can go on. And then you compare them to Spain, which really is a really tough analogy to compare them to Spain, because they have got balance in their team. What Spain haven't got is a Harry Kane. Morata's a good striker, but they haven't got a Harry Kane. They haven't got a Jude Bellingham. They'd take both of those in a heartbeat. But they have got a structure of play that they're happy with. They're confident on the ball. They're confident playing forwards. And I think that's where we find England at the moment. There's a lot of cliches around football. England in the past have been, I mean, they always touted as being arrogant, but I think sometimes it's a lack of belief that's the problem. It's not arrogance. But then, having said that, I think we build up our players too much and then underrate the other countries' players and sides. I mean, they're coming up against a side in Switzerland in the quarterfinals who really impressed me against Italy. They look really well coached. They look balanced. They know when to press. They're going to and they press together. I mean, that was one of the biggest worries for me, was when Harry Kane came out early in the tournament and said, "Well, who starts the press? We don't know. We don't know who triggers the press." I mean, Switzerland will know how to press, and they know that if they press England effectively, they won't have the confidence to play through that press. They'll go backwards and backwards and backwards. So there's a lot of issues for Gareth Southgate to sort. I mean, so as much as you want to celebrate the fact that they got through to the quarterfinals, the harsh reality is that there's a hell of a lot to do to turn this team back round into a side that that we've seen previously, that can play with confidence and play with a bit of bullishness about them and get amongst the Swiss.
And I want to expand on that a little bit more. I watch Italy closely, have a family allegiance to the Italians through my wife, who's of an Italian background, and lots of in-laws and friends, and we get up and go to to Carlton, the Little Italy of Melbourne, to watch games at ridiculous hours. That Swiss team took Italy apart. Now, this is obviously not and far from the best Italian side that we've seen in recent generations. And most nations would say, look, if over a 20-year period you won a World Cup 2006 and a Euros 2020/21, you'd take that out of 20 years and maybe have a couple of bad experiences. So putting the lackluster nature of the current Italian squad aside, there's no one in their right mind could underestimate Switzerland under Murat Yükün. He's obviously Turkish background, but he's a Swiss international. I was listening to another Swiss international on Talk Sport before we started recording the show this week, Ramon Vega, and they're not talking about just getting through Italy. They're talking about going all the way. And when you, I mean, Jan Sommer won the Serie A with Inter Milan, first choice goalkeeper. You've got first choice players littered from Akanji with City, and I could just rattle them off. But Granit Xhaka, Jerdan Sakiri, Xhaka is just like, he's in imperious form with Leverkusen just coming off winning the Bundesliga. This is a side that is first class quality. I can't see any way that England are going to get through them.
No, there'd have to be a dramatic improvement in England. I mean, I do believe, that England do still possess the players to produce a performance that would be good enough to be the Swiss. But all those factors you just mentioned, I mean, Granit Xhaka looks like a different player when he pulls on a Swiss shirt. And he's going to have a point to prove as well, because he's coming up against Declan Rice in that midfield, who came in at Arsenal and effectively replaced him in many ways. So, he's going to have... he's going to have a point to prove. He'll know that. And he's that sort of character. And he's another one that takes the responsibility on his shoulders. But they are the sum of their parts, if you know what I mean. They do. They all come together and gel as a team. And this is a team game at the end of the day. We could talk about Jude Bellingham's and individuals all we want, but you've got to pull it together as an 11. And Switzerland against Italy did do that. I mean, I saw in Italy's performance something very similar to what England have been producing. Fearful football. What I'd say about Italy is they don't have a front line. They don't have any effective way of turning it around like England did. They haven't got a Harry Kane. They're struggling in that. That Scamacca looks a broken man to me. He really was poor, a passenger in that game. So, I think England will know that as challenging as it has been up to this point, it's only going to get tougher against the Swiss. And people talk about the easy side of the draw and the tougher side of the draw. It doesn't matter. These sides are well drilled. International football is throwing the best of your country into a melting pot and hoping that you make something delicious out of it. But and good coaches can do that. But at the moment, England is struggling to get the ingredients right. I mean, they've got plenty to choose from, but Switzerland has just got the magic recipe at the moment. So it's going to be a really tough one next weekend.
A few Hoyts and herbs and spices might help in that delicious recipe there, Rob. As we look to a couple of the teams that I think are cooking up something really good, it's pretty brutal that Germany and Spain are going to meet at this quarterfinal stage, but you've got to meet at some point. The home side took a while in the torrential downpour against Denmark, and people say the game swung on two moments, which it did, but I think by the end of the game, the chances that Havertz had, I think it looked pretty comfortable. Your thoughts on Nagelsmann's side, and then I will ask you on Spain, who you did touch on briefly, but we'll expand out.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I said about people sort of overplaying England's hand in terms of the talent they've got, we went into this tournament, everybody was going, Foden's been fantastic for Man City. Yeah, but he's been playing as a 10, not off the left. Saka been injured a lot, but they were building up Foden and Saka. And then you look at Musiala and Wirtz for Germany, and I think they are two top young talents that really do carry a threat throughout the pitch. Really are impressed with them. Toni Kroos running the show still at his age in midfield. I mean, this is the, again, taking it back to England, he's the sort of player that English football doesn't really produce. You know, a player that can get his head up, get the ball off the back four, get his head up and play and go forwards. You know, we create box-to-box midfielders. We create combative midfielders, neat and tidy midfielders. To be somebody that creative, you know, that I know he had a lot of time in the opening games to play. I mean, against the Scots, I've never seen a side sit off so much and let him play. You know, he's a guy that can destroy you with one pass and you're going to give him all the time in the world to pick it. Nobody putting any pressure on him. Scotland were abysmal that night. But, you know, he is a very effective player still at his age and he pulls the strings. But he's got two young talents in front of him that that he can pick out. So I've been very impressed with Germany. And obviously, home advantage as well. Have to say, I've not been impressed with the pitches so far. They've been cutting up far too much. We're not used to that in the Premier League. I know that the Premier League is a much richer league than the Bundesliga, but those surfaces, I mean, a lot of them look like they've just been freshly laid and abysmal. Having said that, I mean, I do think the VAR decisions were key in that game. And again, it was the English officials. I mean, I tweeted the one positive for England is that they can't get English officials in this tournament because the VAR, we're seeing them use VAR, how they use it in the Premier League, where everybody else, all the other officials, seem to be using it very fast, limitedly as well. They're not using it all the time. They're not forensically examining every detail. I mean, that handball for me was just ridiculous. Yes, it touched his hand. Why have we got a snickometer in a ball? What we thought we were simplifying VAR. Why complicate it by putting a sensor in it so you can tell if it's brushed somebody's finger? It didn't change the trajectory. Nobody appealed for it. It was a natural position for a defender to be in. Why are we having to go back and look at that again to give a penalty? It just seems really bizarre how you can take VAR and all its problems and all the reasons people criticise it and add more to it, another layer of criticism on it. Let's put something else in there. Honestly, that was... I mean, I thought Germany would have come out on top ultimately, but you don't want that. It was really poor use of VAR. It's not what your VAR... That wasn't clear and obvious. That wasn't why VAR was brought in. And again, I bet you don't see any other officials from any other countries use it in that way.
Okay, the snickerometer, just not cricket, Rob. And Spain, you spoke of them. Morata, not Harry Kane, but... And this isn't a Spanish side of the three-peat, the two Euros and the World Cup from a decade ago, and everyone could list off the players in that side. This isn't that side, but maybe Morata's leadership rather than his ability is what this requires. They've got some really old players in there, Carvajal and Jesus Navas. They've got some really young players in there, Pedri, Nico Williams, Yamal, and I think it looks a very balanced side. And they did go a goal down to Georgia, who hassled them for all they were worth, but the 4-1 in the end, that didn't seem unfair either.
No, they played some superb football last night, as you'd expect with Spain. I mean, it's not quite the tiki-taka that it used to be, but yeah, it's still very progressive football. Players that are confident to get on the ball, to look forwards, to get their heads up, to know where their teammates are going to be, well-drilled. They are a team. They're my favourites. They are my favourites to go the whole way in this tournament. If England came up against them in the form they're in at the moment, they would end up with a 4-1 as well. You know, they're that good in terms of playing through teams. I mean, Georgia ended so much energy, so much heart, pressing. They gave Spain a test early doors, but they were up for that test. They could play through it. They carried on playing the football that they're known for. So I'm very impressed with Spain so far.
Now, Rob, we couldn't have you on and let you go without asking, as we look ahead to the Premier League after the Euros are over, Enzo Marasca's moved on to a bigger contract. Will it be a better contract? Will he finally get a tune out of Chelsea? We'll find that out in the fullness of time. But Steve Cooper, he when you look back at his pedigree, you know, he comes through the England coaching ranks. He's had his fingerprints on players like, you know, Jadon Sancho, Phil Foden, current members of the England squad, Colin Gallagher, Mark Gahey. So, you know, much loved at Forest for a while there. Looked like he was never going to get sacked. But eventually they pulled the trigger on him and he was gone. So what do you make of his appointment at Leicester City? I mean, he looks a lot older than he is. I mean, he's only 44 years old, so not one of the younger brigade, but certainly not a veteran by any stretch. Do you think he's the right man for the job?
Yeah, I think he actually is. I know when Enzo left, the club said to me, you know, we're wedded to the idea, the approach, the philosophy, not the man. You know, what we want to carry on in a similar vein. And there was a couple of candidates. They had ended up with a three-man shortlist, and there was a couple of candidates. Carlos Calderon at West Bromwich Albion plays a very similar style of football, possession-based, playing out from the back. Their long-time fancied man, Graham Potter, who they've tried to get in on a couple of occasions. And I think they decided they wanted to go with Potter, but in the background was Steve Cooper. Potter was hesitating, so they decided just to get Cooper in. And when you look at his record, his history, I mean, he's been coaching since he was 20. So, you know, he is very experienced coach, even though he's only 44. You know, his career didn't quite pan out how he wanted it to at Wrexham as a player. Played a bit of non-league football, but also did his badges at the same time. And you look at him and, you know, he was at Liverpool under Rafa Benitez. You know, he had a couple of Spanish coaches helping him when he was at the academy then. So he's got that sort of influence there. His sides at times have played aggressive attacking football the first year at Forest when he took them from the relegation zone to promotion in one season. But then, you know, he followed Potter in at Swansea and some of the Swansea fans were a bit resistant to him because they thought his football was a bit more basic than what they'd seen under Potter and they liked that. So we've got a sense that he's a more pragmatic coach. He's going to come in and assess what he's got. Right? I mean, Enzo come in and said, this is how I'm going to play. If these players can't fit, then I don't want them. You know, this is the way. And everybody else has got to adapt to the way. Cooper will probably come in and look at it and go, right, okay, I've got attacking fullbacks in Victor Christiansen, who didn't get a look in under Enzo. James Justin, Ricardo Pereira. So I'm going to play with attacking fullbacks. I've got centre halves that are a bit slow. Perhaps I'll play with the back three. He's going to look at it like this. I don't think he's going to come in and go, this is my way, this is my philosophy, this is my idea. I think he's going to be the other way around. He's going to be more pragmatic about it. Because the reality is, Leicester are in the Premier League. They've sold a lot of good players. They're in the process of selling Kieran Dewsbury-Hall now to Chelsea as well. The £30 million to ease any concerns over PSR. So they are going to be one of the favourites for relegation. So they're going to have to be pragmatic about how they go about this season and this transfer window. And I think Steve Cooper, he kept Forest up in the first season back in the Premier League doing that. I mean, they sat in a low block. You know, he played 4-3-3, but they're very defensive 4-3-3 and looked to hit teams on the counter-attack and it worked for them in that season. If you can stay up in the first season and build on that in the next window when you haven't got PSR concerns because you've got rid of all your high earners, then, you know, you can build again. And that's what Leicester need to do. They've got back up at the first bounce and they need to now just build slowly for the next few years. And perhaps they can get back to the level they were before. PSR is an absolute joke, by the way. I mean, the clubs are doing deals with each other now. Mm. I mean, the June 30th it was a soft deadline. It was almost like another transfer deadline day. Yeah. That's the end of the accountancy year. So clubs are desperately trying to sell players so they can get into PSR, but they're doing little side deals to balance it all up as well. So it really needs looking at. But that's why the Kieran Dewsbury-Hall deal is pretty much done now, just to make it into that accounting year. And the fact that they sold Harvey Barnes and Timothy Castagna at the start of the accounting year, now they've sold Kieran Dewsbury-Hall at the end, it might be enough. It might be enough for them to avoid a second breach, but they're still looking at the prospect of points deduction.
And can you believe, Rob, we're halfway through the Euros and it's the 1st of July as we record and it's next month, just what, little less than seven weeks away before the new Premier League season starts. So
feels like a long time though, Rob, since the end of the season as well.
Yeah,
like a long time ago since they won the championship. With the championships, the European championships in the middle of it, it still feels like a long summer this time.
Yeah. I guess when you plonk a big tournament like this with all the expectation and the big match days around it, it's going to feel like that. But it's going to be here in no time, isn't it, mate? Hey, Rob, we better let you go. We could always chat. It always feels like we're breasting up against the bar, having a yarn with a mate when we talk to you, and we do tend to get a bit carried away, mate. So, look, good luck to England. I've got to say that when they did win, I was sort of pleased because a lot of my media consumption is around reading articles on The Athletic and the BBC and The Guardian and listening to podcasts, and I would have thought it was going to get a bit boring if England are out of it. And it's just great to hear, you know, people, the misery guts of just whinging about the results and Gareth Southgate and what happens if they win. I mean, that's just going to shock everybody if they do and turn
it would be a shock, I think.
Yeah.
It would be a shock if they went all the way. Yeah. But you never know. I mean, the Euros was always thrown up, traditionally, has thrown up shocks.
Oh,
I mean, Greece got through playing really defensive football and won it.
Portugal had three draws, finished third in their group, and went on and won it, mate. So, look, you only have to be in form on the last day. So that's all that matters. Rob, thanks again, my friend.
Cheers. No problem. See you guys.
Excellent. Rob Tanner from The Athletic. He's a good man of our podcast. He's been with us since day one and always there ready to have a yarn about football. Stick around. World Cup Corner next on Box to Box.
Willa, willa, willa. Everybody's going to buy Hoyt's Spices. Everyone's going to save a dollar or two. Everybody's going to buy Hoyt's Spices, yeah.
Oh, it's time for flavor-packed meals. Edge, when was the last time you had a lamb roast with all the lovely roast vegetables, potatoes, carrots, pumpkin, some onions even in there, and a great gravy?
The last time I was, when I was back in Australia in August of last year, September of last year, and I went over to my mum's place and she cooked a roast lamb. And she had, instead of the gravy though, we had the mint sauce.
Oh, delicious. I mean, I love the mint sauce. It goes well with the gravy. And if you want to make a mint sauce, then you can use the Hoyt's dried mint. It does a fantastic job. You find it a recipe anywhere, and it's just got that really rich flavour of mint that you get out of it. But also, Willem, what's another herb that you might associate with a lamb roast?
Ooh, garam masala?
Yeah, well, if you're making an Indian lamb roast, it might be. I was thinking more along the lines of rosemary. Rosemary is a great herb that goes...
Oh, yep.
Just talk to Cheryl. She'll tell you, the great Willem's mum. She's the gourmet cook at his place. You just get a nice mix of dried rosemary. You could use fresh if you like, but fresh, dried rosemary, again, a really rich, pungent flavours with olive oil, the Hoyt's four-colour.
Peppercorn mix.
Correct. And the Hoyt's Himalayan rock salt. Rub it in, make a nice crust, some slivers of fresh garlic. Roast it just nicely for about probably 300 degrees, I reckon, for 20 minutes. That's a really hot temperature, but it seals it nicely, and then bang it down to about 150 for an hour and a half, depending on the weight. You are going to have the best roast lamb, veggies, get all the fat off, make the gravy. You'll be happy with Hoyt's at Coles, Woolworths, and all good independent supermarkets.
Fill those empties with Hoyt's spices, yeah.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Always great talking to our good mate Rob Tanner about football. But Edge, you always keep an eye on the younger groups of Socceroos and Matildas coming through. And there's some good news. We talked about this briefly last week, but tell us all about it.
Well, I thought that we'd make an update just to see how young Quinn McNichol and Anthony Didelica are doing in the Joey. So it's the current under-16 Australian boys team at the ASEAN Championships. A bit of a warm-up event for the under-17 FIFA World Cup qualification process through Asia. Australia drew with Thailand in their opening game 0-0. They defeated Malaysia 2-0 and then defeated Timor-Leste 12-0. And they're in the semi-finals playing Indonesia in about an hour's time while we record this on a Monday night. But what was interesting, I thought we should just see how the two boys are going. And it was Quinn McNichol, he scored 4 goals against Team Alest, and Anthony Didalitza scored also 4 goals. But Anthony has also scored a crucial goal in the 2-0 win over Malaysia, who's a more competitive group. So, yeah, they're doing exceptionally well. And the A-League, 9 A-League prospects were in the starting 11 of that game against Timor Leste, which is just fantastic that the A-League's still producing these sort of... I guess this cycle is an interesting one because there's some... the people who know what they're talking about in my network say that this is a very good crop of young Socceroos, of Joeys, of the junior Socceroos, and that we should have some expectations that they could do exceptionally well in Asia and then into the under-17 FIFA World Cup for men or for boys. So, yeah, interesting. I just thought we'd give an update. Those two famous names from Australian football, Didalicka and McNichol, well and truly amongst the best players.
Rob, did you just get the feeling that you and I are among the people in Edge's network who don't know what they're talking about?
Well, I think he doesn't mind a little drive-by from time to time. So, you know, you could read that into it. So, but we learn from him, don't we? We have the good fortune to sit at his knee just every single week. Yeah, and they're just basking the halo of his expertise, mate. That's what we do.
I was talking to a couple of coaches who are one who's there and another one who's watching very closely. So,
mate, they've got there's a microphone and a platform for them, mate. You can invite them on the show anytime you like, Edge.
Come and educate some clowns anytime.
But the question that I wanted to ask was, I know we've discussed this over recent times, and it sort of talks to the fact that the A-League clubs are losing a significant portion of their funding in the current cycle. So, Edge, how much of this young crop of players do you see insofar as the money that the clubs will make from the transfer market offsetting some of the losses of the distribution?
That's a real focus for clubs now is the A-League is entrenched as a development league, and it's the opportunity to cultivate players and transfer them overseas and sell, which was pretty much how the old NSL clubs used to survive, you know, back at my club at Heidelberg back in the day when I was going around. Players were sold, and that was sort of the revenue for the next season almost. So it's not too dissimilar to that situation, the way it's evolving at the moment.
Well, obviously there's some of the European competitions, the second-tier European competitions that are considered from outsiders as development leagues. But, Willem, you're in Amsterdam right now. One of those leagues is the Eredivisie. Do the Dutch consider their competition a development league, or is that just an observation that we make from the outside?
No, 100% they do, and there's just no awkwardness about it. They're just very realistic and pragmatic, and they know that they're tucked in behind the big four or the big four and a half, if you like. So there's no awkwardness about it. They just accept it. They enjoy the players while they've got them. Ajax had a terrible season, but Brian Brobbey was scoring the bulk of their goals, and they go, oh, yeah, he's good while he's here. He'll be gone. And, you know, if the connection is strong enough with the club, they might come back. But going back to the days of Johan Cruyff, Ajax legend, but he went and played at Feyenoord. And this comes to my next point. I want to speak about Patrick Kisnorbo moving to Melbourne Victory. There's also a sort of a pragmatic realism around the Dutch idea that so many of their great players will pass through at least two of PSV, Ajax, or Feyenoord at some stage in their career, whether that be the start and the finish. And that, for me, doesn't quite sit as well. I don't really like that. But in terms of them seeing themselves as a development league, yeah, they are pretty cut and dry about it. So on to that point with Kisnorbo, he is the new Victory boss on a 3-year deal. It had been rumoured for some time. And if you sort of piece between or read between a few of the lines, they had tried to get other candidates through the door, but it is Kisnorbo. Here is Victory chairman John Dovaston on that appointment.
It's the most important appointment in a club. It's someone that you look to bring your success. It's someone that brands the club. And so what we really wanted was someone that had proven experience as a player, someone that's transitioned into a coaching role, someone that has experience with the youth, the women, and obviously the A-League men. That experience is something that Patrick has. Patrick's Melbourne-born, grew up in the suburbs, and so he brings an understanding of the environment the game's played in. He's also played at a highest level in the youth, being a representative of Australia, both in youth and also as a Socceroo. He's transitioned into a coaching role and had early success in that. And we think, therefore, Patrick met the criteria that we were after, and someone that can in fact take Melbourne Victory forward for the next 3 years.
I speak now as a fan. You can't argue with any of that. He's a top candidate, and he's had a fantastic career as a player and manager across youth, women's, and the A-League men's senior. But that little term he used in there, the brand, just really shits me up the wall. Like, you try so hard, if you're passionate and engaged in a club member, to put aside all the administrative chaos, all the disappointment week to week, and just focus on getting excited about your team, feeling a healthy rivalry towards the opposition. Kis Norbo is City heart through and through, played in the early derbies against Victory, played in the sort of bigger derbies for City against Victory. He's gone and achieved it all over there. And then you're asked to go and front up and pay your membership because he's the new man on the touchline. I remember when Ninkovic moved from Sydney FC to the Wanderers, I was not particularly impressed with that. And you guys said, oh, that's football. These things happen all the time. And yeah, on occasion it does happen, but Kis Norbo to Victory. Please jump in.
No, it's a good point you make, because, it's been alive, this issue amongst Melbourne Victory fans. And, Melbourne Victory fans don't like him, put it that way. But no. They have to like him now, don't they? And I guess they'll get to know him over time, and it's something that they'll have to talk about. The big rejection they had was they had a real dash at Mile Jedinak, who's assistant to Ange Postecoglou at the moment. And obviously, I don't think they had the financial muscle to shift him from Tottenham. But... what about the exit of Tony Popovich? There's a lot of questions in all of this, isn't there? But there has been rumoured that Melbourne Victory, you had to take, like most clubs, had to take $1 million out of their expenditure, and they decided to take a big chunk out of it out of the senior coach's contract. So, yeah, he's definitely wasn't the first choice. So what number choice he was, I guess we'll never know. But, they're very real emotional points you make, and especially when fans have rusted on emotional connections. I know back in the day, I was a passionate Heidelberg person. So used to me drive me up the bend when South Melbourne would pinch our best players.
Ernie Merrick, Kevin Muscat, Archie Thompson, Danny Allsopp, these were Victory players, Victory people, and the supporters were very proud. Even when Popovich came in, it was a little bit uneasy. While he hadn't worked at Wanderers and Perth, not the biggest rivals, but it was like, are we no longer sort of running our own show? Are we sort of looking over the, sort of looking elsewhere? And yeah, they brought in Postecoglou, they brought in Berisha. So it's a vexed issue, and it's not, either here or there. But I think now to go and get Kis Norbo, that's a real admission that you're well behind what city you're developing, and you need a little bit of that in your doors, Rob.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really pissed you off was the use of the word brand as well. That was something that that leapt out to me when you were expressing your views. And I think you expressed the views of a lot of Victory supporters a relatively inexperienced chairman using marketing and advertising kind of language in that setting is not the kind of environment that you want to be doing it, especially when you're bringing an archenemy into the folds of the club. You want to be talking about far more grassroots, fundamental football language rather than that kind of discussion, because it just doesn't sit well and it's not convincing to the fans' edge when it comes to persuading them.
Let's change gears, Willem, and just make a brief comment about Alan Stajic to Western Sydney. He comes in, the chairman, who's by all accounts dropped a serious amount of money into that club, is out the door because he got outvoted by two other directors. I mean, what does that say it just seems the controversy seems to follow Alan where he goes.
Yeah, you did drop that one in last week, yeah.
Yeah, but it's an interesting one. I mean, Paul Lederer, he's a backroom person in the context of football in Australia, but he was a big part of Sydney FC's early success. He pretty much got on board with the Wanderers in the early days, and he's really pumped a lot of money in, and he would have to leave a big hole, at least a financial hole, at Western Sydney.
He's staying involved as a stakeholder and I think an advisor. I could have that wrong, but he is staying involved. But certainly that big job as a board member, one of three board members, getting outvoted by the other two, that would leave him feeling very dirty. David Zrilic also confirmed on a three-year deal at Perth Glory. I think that's really exciting. And you mentioned Mile Jedinak. He stays at Tottenham Edge, but he's joined on Ange's coaching staff by Nick Montgomery, who Victory, I think, did have a bit of a dip at, and his number two, Sergio Raimundo. So that's exciting. Ryan Mason, a name that we all know pretty well, still there as well.
Their Australian fingerprints down at White Hart Lane, or you know, the new White Hart Lane, Tottenham Hotspur Stadium these days, are getting more and more present. Let's see what they can do next year with Ange in charge. All right, let's wrap it up there, boys. We've got stoppage time later in the week. Back to its usual time, gentlemen. We're going to drop it on a Thursday morning, as we typically do, so that you can have a little bit more time to enjoy the main show and a bit more football between now and then. Michael, until then, have a good couple of days.
Thank you, Rob and Willem, and listeners. Hope you enjoy the Euro and Copa knockout phase.
Willem? Well done.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, everybody.
And to Adam Maloney, thanks again, mate, for all the work you do, making sure that that the real grind of this podcast is done, whether it's editing the clips for us, whether it's making sure that the show is seamed together, whether it's dropping the show at all the right times for our listeners. Thank you, mate. You do an outstanding job. And to our listeners, as we always say every week, if you have a moment, please leave us a review. It makes a big, big difference to podcasts and podcast catches and ratings around the world, wherever you listen to your favourite shows. And subscribe to the show, of course, Box to Box, Stoppage Time and Offside. Tweet us at Box to Box NTS and follow us on X. Make sure you like us on Facebook as well, and join us throughout the week as our podcasts drop and we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.